Okay, ready to dive in?
Absolutely.
We've got a fascinating case in front of us today,
Yeah.
ripped straight from the legal history books.
It's a good one.
Think financial intrigue meets journalistic ethics.
Ooh.
We're talking about the 80s Wall Street and the Wall Street Journal itself.
Yeah, this case really probes the gray areas of insider trading.
Right.
It's not your typical story of a corporate executive leaking secrets.
No.
It's about the power of information,
Okay.
even seemingly mundane details like a publication schedule, and the ethical lines we draw in the pursuit of profit.
Exactly. We're going to break down a pivotal legal opinion,
Yes.
United States v. Wyness,
Made one.
which tested the limits of insider trading laws.
Absolutely.
Get this? It involved a Wall Street Journal reporter, R. Foster Wyness,
Okay.
who used his knowledge of upcoming heard on the street columns to make some serious money in the stock market.
Wow.
Yeah.
What's fascinating here is that Winans wasn't trading on insider information from the companies being written about, but from his own newspaper.
That's wild.
He, along with a stockbroker, Peter Brandt, and later a news clerk named Kenneth Felis,
Okay.
formed a scheme to profit from the market impact of the journal's own influential columns.
So let's get into the nitty-gritty of this scheme. How did it all work?
Well, Winans would tip off Brandt and Felis about which companies would be featured in upcoming Heard on the Street columns.
Okay.
And these columns, as you know, had a reputation for moving markets.
For sure.
Armed with this pre-publication knowledge, Brandt and Felis would buy or sell stock in those companies, anticipating the market reaction once the column went public.
It's like they were piggybacking on the journal's own credibility to manipulate the market.
Exactly.
How much were we talking about here? Did they make a significant profit?
They were quite successful, actually.
Right.
Court records show that they made almost $690,000 in profits.
Wow.
And to cover their tracks, they used various trading accounts set up in different names.
Clever, but ultimately not clever enough. How did their scheme eventually unravel?
It was actually Kidder Peabody Brandt's employer
Okay.
that brought the whole thing down. Their compliance department noticed some unusual trading activity that seemed to be linked to the publication of these Heard on the Street articles.
Interesting.
They started digging deeper.
Yeah.
And eventually, the trail led back to Winans, Brandt, and Felis.
And that's when the legal hammer came down?
Absolutely. They were charged with a whole slew of offenses:
Yep.
securities fraud, mail fraud, wire fraud, and conspiracy.
Why?
The trial itself was a bench trial, meaning it was decided by a judge rather than a jury.
Okay, and what was the judge's verdict?
All three were found guilty.
And this is where the case gets really interesting from a legal perspective.
Oh, yeah.
The court's decision in United States v. Wyness actually expanded the traditional definition of insider trading. Okay, let's unpack this. How did they redefine insider trading? So how did United States v. Wyness change our understanding of insider trading?
Well, the court used what's called the misappropriation theory to convict Winans. This theory says that you can be found guilty of insider trading, even if you're not a traditional corporate insider,
Interesting.
if you misuse confidential information for your own profit.
Okay.
Even if that information doesn't come from the company whose stock you're trading,
Right.
you can still be held liable.
So in Wienand's case, it wasn't about him having insider information on the companies being written about in the Heard on the Street column.
Right.
It was about him misusing information that belonged to his employer, the Wall Street Journal.
Exactly. The court argued that Winans had a duty of confidentiality to the journal.
Okay.
By leaking the publication schedule, he was essentially stealing the journal's intellectual property and using it for his own financial gain.
It's like using the company car to run a side hustle.
Right.
But in this case, the company car was the journal's influence and credibility.
Yeah.
Did the court specifically address how this misuse of information was related to the actual trading of security?
Yes, they did. They were very clear that this misuse of information was directly in connection with the purchase or sale of securities.
Yeah.
This connection is a crucial element of insider trading laws.
So even though Winans wasn't trading on insider information with the companies themselves,
Right.
the court still saw a clear link between his actions and the stock trades.
Yeah, absolutely.
This case had some other interesting legal angles too, right?
Yes.
Didn't Winans try to argue that his conviction violated his First Amendment rights?
That's right. His defense team claimed that the government was infringing on his freedom of speech by trying to control what he could write about.
But the court didn't buy that argument, did they?
No, they didn't. The court pointed out that it wasn't the government restricting Winans' speech.
Okay.
It was the journal's own confidentiality rules, okay, which Winans had agreed to as part of his employment.
Right.
The court essentially said, you can write whatever you want, but you can't use your position to make illegal trades based on non-public information.
So they drew a clear line between journalistic freedom and using your position for illegal financial gain.
Exactly.
But it sounds like this case wasn't completely cut and dry. Was there any dissent from the judge's decision?
There was one of the judges filed a dissenting opinion arguing that the misappropriation theory shouldn't be stretched this far.
Interesting.
This judge felt that the case was more about protecting the journal's reputation than about preventing harm to the securities markets.
So from the dissenting judge's perspective, Wina's actions were more of an internal matter between him and his employer,
yeah,
rather than a threat to the broader financial system.
That's right.
Did the dissenting judge think that Winans should have gotten off scot-free?
Not exactly. The dissenting judge believed that the mail and wire fraud convictions were sufficient to address Winans' actions.
Okay.
These convictions were based on Winans' use of the mail and telephone to communicate with his co-conspirators.
So even the dissenting judge agreed that Winans had committed crime.
Yes.
But disagreed with applying the insider trading law in this specific situation.
Right.
But ultimately, the majority opinion prevailed, and Winans was convicted. What were the consequences for him and his co-conspirators?
Well, Winans was sentenced to 18 months in prison, fined $5,000.
Wow.
And ordered to pay back a portion of his illegal profits. Carpenter received a three-month prison sentence, a $1,000 fine.
Yeah.
And was ordered to perform 500 hours of community service.
Wow.
Felis also faced prison time and fines for his role in the scheme.
So there were real repercussions for their actions. What are some of the key takeaways from this case, especially for our listeners who are interested in the world of finance and information?
Well, the Winans case really cemented the misappropriation theory as a powerful tool for prosecutors to go after insider trading.
Mm-hmm.
It's a clear message that it's not just about corporate insiders anymore.
Right.
Anyone who misuses confidential information for stock market gains, even if it's information about their own employer,
right,
can be held liable.
It broadens the scope of insider trading laws considerably.
It does.
It's not just about stealing company secrets anymore.
It's about the misuse of any non-public information that could give someone an unfair advantage in the market.
Exactly. Winans showed that seemingly unimportant information, like a publication schedule,
right,
can be considered material and valuable in the context of insider trading.
So it's really about understanding that information is a form of currency, especially in the financial world.
Yeah. It's a stark reminder that we need to be mindful of how we handle information.
It is.
Especially in today's world where data is everywhere.
Absolutely. Winans serves as a cautionary tale for anyone working with sensitive information.
Yeah.
Whether it's in finance, journalism, or any other field.
Right.
It highlights the importance of ethical conduct.
For sure.
And the potential consequences of crossing the line.
Right.
Even if it's a seemingly blurry one.
It also raises some interesting questions about the evolving nature of insider trading.
Yeah.
In the digital age.
Yeah.
Think about all the information that's readily available online.
On social media, or even just within our own workplaces, what might seem like a harmless piece of information to one person,
right,
could be incredibly valuable to someone else, particularly in the right context.
It's true. The Winans case, though, decided decades ago,
yeah,
is surprisingly relevant to the information age we live in now.
It
forces us to think critically about the power of information and the responsibility that comes with access to it.
It's a reminder that we all have a role to play in maintaining a fair and transparent system.
Yes.
Whether we're talking about Wall Street or our everyday interactions, it's crucial to be aware of the potential impact of our actions.
Absolutely.
Especially when it comes to handling information.
The Winans case serves as a powerful reminder that seemingly insignificant details can have major consequences, especially in the world of finance.
Right.
It underscores the importance of ethical decision making and the need for constant vigilance in safeguarding confidential information.
Well said. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into a truly fascinating and thought-provoking case. We'll catch you next time for another deep dive into the world of information and ideas.